Hey everyone, welcome into another Pipeline podcast. Tim McMaster here along with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo of MLBPipeline.com. On the podcast today, we're going to talk about Tim Tebow. We've avoided Tim Tebow for a couple of weeks, guys, but it's time to talk about him again because he's headed to Arizona as part of the AFL representing the Mets down there. But before we get to Tebow, we're going to talk about the current playoff teams, how their rosters were built, because a lot of these teams are built significantly from within. There's trades, there's free agent signings, and it's fascinating to see how the different teams kind of put together their postseason club and a successful team that's made it this far. We've already obviously lost the Mets from the postseason. We've also lost the Orioles, so we won't talk about those teams. But the eight teams that remain in October, we will break down. We'll go division by division, and let's start or series by series, I should say. So let's start with the Red Sox and Indians, guys. And Jim, I'll start with you and the Red Sox, because this is a team, obviously a lot of young talent there in Boston, also some key veterans. How did this team all get put together?
I thought the Red Sox were one of the more interesting teams. I mean, we do this series every year, and I always find it fun to look at how the teams were assembled. Tim, I thought it was one of the more interesting teams because, A, they kind of had the most balanced approach with some homegrown players and traded players and free agent players. They kind of mirrored the average of the 10 teams that made it to the playoffs. They had 9 homegrown, 11 trade acquisition, and 5 free agents. It was also interesting, they had 3 different front office regimes that could all claim a significant hand in this. Theo Epstein, even though it seems like he's been gone for a long time, and he has acquired 9 of these players. Ben Cherington, I think, had 10. And then David Dombrowski, who's been, and Mike Hazen has been the GM under David Dombrowski for a little bit more than a year, had, I believe, 6 is what it came down to. So it was kind of interesting. I think the biggest, method or biggest impact was the 2011 draft, where they got Jackie Bradley Jr., Mookie Betts, who could be the MVP, Travis Shaw, Matt Barnes will pitch out of the bullpen, and it might even be stronger down the road. That draft might look even better if Blake Swihart and Henry Owens look as good as they did in the minors. So that was really a big part of building this team, was that one draft. They also have a guy from last year's draft, 2015, Andrew Benintendi, I think is the only 2015 draftee in the playoffs. You can go back to 2004 with Dustin Pedroia, their top pick that year. Only one international signee, but it was a really good one. Xander Bogaerts, who's a guy who they actually, Mike Lord, the scout who signed him, actually spotted his twin brother Jair first, asked if there's anybody else he should see, and Jair said, "I've got a brother who's home sick with the chicken pox." So some good scouting, some good diligence there. They worked Xander Bogaerts out and found him before everybody else did. So a lot of that's the homegrown aspect. From a trade standpoint, a big part of this roster is a result of Ben Cherington trades. Eduardo Rodriguez came over from the Orioles for Andrew Miller. When they traded John Lester at the trade deadline in 2014, they got Yoenis Cespedes, who they then spun to the Tigers, who Dave Dombrowski was running the show there at the time, and got Rick Porcello, who might be a Cy Young Award winner. Dombrowski's obviously made a couple big trades with the Padres to bring in Craig Kimbrell and bring in Drew Pomeranz. Pomeranz has not worked out as well. That deal's somewhat controversial because medical information was withheld. And then from a free agent standpoint, remember the last time the Red Sox won the World Series, Ben Cherington signed 7 kind of mid-level free agents, all of whom had good years to contribute to that World Series championship. Recently, they've gone for some bigger ticket guys. Hanley Ramirez has bounced back after a rough first year. David Price, maybe not quite as dominant as they hoped after signing a record contract for pitcher, but he has helped stabilize that rotation. And then maybe the best free agent signing dollar for dollar of all time was David Ortiz signing a non-guaranteed one-year, $1.25 million contract in 2003, and wasn't even guaranteed a job at that point. He was kind of an extra option at DH. Obviously, he's been part of 3 World Series championships, making a run at a 4th, and probably had the best farewell season anybody's ever had this year, leading the majors in doubles, extra base hits, slugging, and ops.
Yeah, I think that's safe to say as far as the best last season, especially for a 40-year-old, that is for sure. Jonathan, this Indians team has had to deal with injuries, as every team does, and they've been helped as far as those injuries go by their own system.
Yeah, they certainly have, and there is a good amount of homegrown players there. I think it ended up being with nine total homegrown players. Jan Gomes ends up being added, and he's a traded player. So that changed the projected roster a little bit as he made a somewhat miraculous recovery from his injury. But probably the biggest injury that they had to overcome was Michael Brantley pretty much being a complete non-factor. And the job that Tyler Naquin did stepping in and soaking up a lot of that playing time and being extremely productive is a huge reason why the Indians won the AL Central. Obviously, when you talk about homegrown players, that kind of have to start, and you could argue start and end with Francisco Lindor, who's already become kind of the heart and soul of that team and will continue to do so for as long as he's in an Indians uniform. Another terrific year for him. As I was looking through this, I was talking, you have him and Jason Kipnis, and then you look on the Red Sox side, and you've got Pedroia and Bogarts, and those are probably the two best all-homegrown middle infield, double play combinations that I could think of. So a little nice little tidbit there. But, the Indians, where they've probably been the most successful has been via trades. Now, a lot of them were smaller trades, bringing in minor leaguers who then turned into Carlos Santana and Corey Kluber. But they were big players this year at the trade deadline. And while they weren't able to land Jonathan Lucroy, they were able to get Andrew Miller for Clint Frazier and Justus Sheffield. So they paid a price, but they'll have Miller under control for a couple of more years. And not only did he solidify their bullpen, which would have been important, but especially because some of those injuries that you mentioned, Tim, happened to the starting rotation. The fact they were able to stretch out their bullpen, that shortened the game for some of the starters that had to step in and fill the void, and that made it a little bit easier for the Indians. And then finally, free agents. The Indians aren't huge players in the free agent market. They don't have the payroll to do that. But, the two big signings for this year, one was Rajai Davis, and his presence certainly helped also fill the void with Michael Brantley being out, and he had a very good year. But Mike Napoli has been huge, not just in terms of the power and run production in the middle of the lineup. He's had arguably the best year of his career, but also just the personality, leadership, those kinds of things that he's brought. And, this is a guy who pretty much is in the postseason every single year, eighth time in the last 10 seasons. And after a certain point in time, I know one guy can't make a team a postseason team, but you build a reputation as being a guy that's on winning teams, and that has proven to be the case over the course of his career.
And, of course, he was a part of the Red Sox in 2013 when they won the World Series. Jonathan, who do you like to win the series?
That's a tough one. I know the Indians finished with a better record, but I don't know, something tells me that the Red Sox win this series in five games and move on to the ALCS.
And how about you, Jim? You got a winner?
Pick the Red Sox. I just think that there are too many questions for me to decide. In fact, too many questions with the Indians' rotation right now. Even Corey Kluber isn't 100%. They're going to have to start guys on short rest. They really only have, I think, two starters they fully trust. So I think the Red Sox pull this one out.
All right, let's jump over to the National League so we don't make those National League fans wait. And the NLDS that's been set that didn't have to wait for a wild card winner is the Dodgers and the Nationals. Jim, I'll start with you again in the Dodgers. And obviously this is a team with a high payroll, a high budget, but that's not necessarily how the roster breaks down.
No, I mean, you would think, for a team that set a major league record for payroll spending in 2014 and then broke in 2015 and had the highest opening day payroll of almost $250 million this year, that they'd have free agents all over the place. And they really don't. I mean, they've re-signed some key guys, the original homegrown guys, and they've taken on some expensive contracts. But from a free agent standpoint, only three free agents on the team, and none of them were big signings. In fact, we were just talking about the bargain with the Red Sox that David Ortiz was. I'm not going to put Justin Turner in David Ortiz's class, but Justin Turner was signed. You know, he was just kind of a journeyman utility guy when he signed a minor league deal worth $1 million going into 2014 season, and he wound up hitting .340 that year, and then set career highs for homers and RBIs last year. And then this year led the team with 27 homers and 90 RBIs. So he was a nice free agent pickup. But really, this team has been acquired mostly through trades. They traded for 13 of 25 players on the roster. That's the second highest total among any of the playoff teams. Even though Andrew Friedman has only been in charge for 2 years, he's actually put his stamp on this roster. He traded, since he's taken over, he's traded for Kiki Hernandez, Hallie Kendrick, Yasmani Grandal, Grant Dayton, Luis Avalon, Alex Wood, Chase Utley, Rich Hill, Josh Reddick, Jesse Chavez, Carlos Ruiz. Now I'll catch my breath after plowing through all those. So he's made a number of deals. Obviously the one that'll probably have the biggest impact this year will be the Rich Hill, Josh Reddick trade he made around the trade deadline. And then even though they have spent a boatload of money and they have assembled the majority of the roster via trades, two things do stand about them in terms of homegrown. One, they have 5 international players, which is tied for the most in baseball. They have some big-ticket guys there, like Kenta Maeda, who's been a godsend for the rotation that's been riddled by injuries. Yasiel Puig signed a $42 million deal. He cost a bunch of money as well. They have Julio Urias, who is going to probably, Jonathan and I, and it seems like Tim, we've talked about this guy all season, eventually becoming maybe the best left-handed pitching prospect or our best left-handed pitcher in baseball in time. I mean, he made the big leagues at 19 this year. And then they got two bullpen pieces who they both signed as position players. Kenley Jansen signed as a catcher for $85,000 out of Curaçao, and Pedro Baez signed for $200,000 as a third baseman out of the Dominican Republic. And then draft-wise, only 4 drafted players, but they made those draft picks count because Clayton Kershaw and Corey Seager are their best pitcher and their best hitter, and Jock Peterson, also a key part of the team, was another draft pick. So mainly trades, but when they've signed those draft guys, they've picked out some good ones.
And then, Jonathan, the basis for this Nationals team obviously all started with those top picks overall in drafts when they were struggling. One of those guys, though, and Steven Strasburg, not part of this team. What about the overall picture for the Nationals?
Yeah, it's interesting because I think if you think about the Nationals and don't really examine it, those are the guys that pop to mind. Going back to Ryan Zimmerman in 2005 from, the Jim Bowden days, top 10 pick, but then Harper and Strasburg, Anthony Rendon back-to-back years. And obviously, those guys are important, especially if Harper can prove that he's healthy. And Rendon has been a vital part to this team as well. Danny Espinosa, has been a mainstay in the infield this year and had a much better second half. Those guys like Ryan Zimmerman isn't quite the major contributor key cog that he once was. So you kind of have to look to see what they've done in other places. I think free agency is the place where they've come up pretty big. Now they've got some interesting role players, guys like Sean Kelly, but I don't think you can overestimate what Daniel Murphy meant to them this year. Again, he's banged up to see what exactly he can bring to the table in the playoffs, but that was a signing coming off of a career in New York. I think some people, myself included, weren't convinced that he would be able to repeat that success, and he did and then some. And then, of course, Max Scherzer, who continues to be one of the best pitchers in baseball, and that's been all the more important, especially with Strasburg in and out with injuries. And they're going to have to lean on Scherzer pretty heavily. And, and in short series, if you have a guy like that to front your rotation, you can do pretty well. And then they've done well in trades, over the years. This year, of course, the big one at the deadline was bringing in Mark Melancon in the hopes that he would solidify their, the back end of their bullpen. And he pretty much has been as advertised, like he was here in Pittsburgh. Nothing flashy, but got the job done. Blew one save all year, post-trade, I should say. And he's not going to be the kind of guy that comes in and lights up the radar gun and blows people away. He just gets it done without a whole lot of drama. And, so, if Scherzer to start games and a guy like Melanson to end them, that's a recipe that has worked for a lot of teams for a long time come postseason play.
So who wins the series?
I'll stick with the Nats. They do have some question marks, but I think Murphy and Harper come back and make the contributions that they can. And I think that Scherzer leads that pitching staff to eat by the Dodgers.
And, Jim, who do you like?
I'm going to take the Dodgers. Kind of the same reason I took the Red Sox. I think if you had fully healthy pitching staffs, this would be a tremendous, tremendous series. And I still think it'll be a good one. But I think, you know, not having Steven Strasburg is going to make a difference. I'm going to pick the Dodgers in five. And again, I mean, we don't have to digress on this for him, but it just again reinforces to me what a terrible decision it was with the way the Nationals handled Steven Strasburg in 2012. They could have set it up where they could have maybe used him in the playoffs. They didn't, with this assumption that they'd be back year after year after year. This is the second playoff appearance since then. And their pitching staff, and unfortunately Strasburg, are undermanned a little bit right now. And I don't think this is going to be the Nationals' year.
All right, back to the American League we go. The Blue Jays survived a tremendous wild card game with the extra inning victory over the Orioles. The Rangers, the top seed in the AL, as they kind of cruise through the 2016 season. Jonathan, I'll let you start this one off with that Rangers team that was so good pretty much from opening day till the end of the season.
Yeah, without much fanfare, and they're a pretty balanced team in terms of finding a mix of players, across the board. They still have a strong contingent of homegrown players, even with some of the trades that they've made, Not necessarily the superstars, but I guess Odor has turned into a really, really good player. Nomar Mazar, of course. Both Odor and Mazar from that 2011 signing period. The Rangers spent a whole lot of money while A.J. Preller was still part of the Rangers front office. Now, of course, the Padres general manager. They've had a good amount of guys come from international and the draft, they're a team that has, I think, the second most. They might have the most international players.
Tied with the Dodgers.
Thank you. So it's been a mix there, but they've also obviously been hugely active in trades. The Cole Hamels one is the one that really jumps out. Last year. And then they went out and got Jonathan Lucroy this year to, help them behind the plate and also with their lineup, getting Carlos Beltran as a rental. This is a team that is kind of in this position every year, and they've been able to do it and still have pieces in their farm system left to deal, make future deals if they want, they've had a good amount of free agent signings that have helped them as well. Probably none more so than Adrian Beltre, who I guess is going to play forever. It continues to be a very productive, high-energy player and has, effectively blocked Joey Gallo from ever trying to play third base at the big league level. And I would be remiss to not mention Matt Busch. We've talked about him before, but just in terms of an interesting sort of minor league free agent signing, given all the issues off the field that he had, he's been a very good part of that bullpen. Another big reason why the Rangers are once again back in postseason play.
Matt Busch, right in the middle of all the controversy with these two teams as well. He was on the mound in May when the benches cleared and that melee went down between the Blue Jays and the Rangers. Jim, your turn. This Blue Jays team, obviously Mark Shapiro, Ross Atkins, haven't been there very long. The regime before them built a lot of this team.
Yeah, and this trade, even the regime before that had a couple key contributions. The Blue Jays, More than half the players on this roster, 13, were the products of trades. Only the Cubs have traded for more players than the Blue Jays among this year's playoff teams. When you go back to 2008, when J.P. Ricciardi stole Jose Bautista before he was Jose Bautista from the Pirates for Robinson Diaz in a straight-up trade. A year later, he got Edwin Encarnacion, obviously the wild card hero, as part of the Scott Rolen trade with the Reds. Alex Anthopoulos made a ton of trades. I think, if I'm not mistaken, I think seven players on this team are players he traded for or claimed on waivers in the last couple of years. He made the Josh Donaldson trade with the Athletics. He stole Devin Travis from the Tigers. He swung a couple blockbusters last year. He got Troy Tulowitzki and David Price to help win last year's title. Price obviously is left as a free agent. Excuse me. Mark Shapiro and Ross Atkins have not had as much time to put as big a stamp on the roster, but they made a trade that really stood out to me as maybe the most interesting trade at this year's deadline. They got Francisco Liriano from the Pirates for Drew Hutchinson, which really helped their rotation. I don't know if they make the playoffs without Francisco Liriano. And then because they took on all of his remaining salary, about $17.5 million, they got two interesting prospects, kind of second-tier prospects, in catcher Reese McGuire and Harold Ramirez. And you don't often see a contender make a trade that helps them now but also adds prospects. So I thought that was interesting. And then while the trades are the bulk of this roster, they have made some nice draft picks. Aaron Sanchez and Marcus Stroman are first-rounders. Aaron Sanchez, supplemental first-rounder, actually, were key parts of that rotation. Roberto Osuna was an international sign, who's their closer. Kevin Pillar, who made another nice defensive play, seems like he makes one of those every game in the wild card contest, was a 33rd-round senior sign for $1,000. That was a nice one. And even though there's only three free agents on the roster, Russell Martin has helped stabilize the pitching staff, and he's provided 43 homers in 2 years with Toronto. And then Jay Happ was dollar for dollar, maybe the best pitching signing in this past offseason, wound up winning 20 games after signing a 3-year, $36 million contract.
So, Jim, who do you like when it's all said and done in that series?
I like the Rangers. I just like the combination of Cole Hamels and Yu Darvish. I think it's a little bit better than what the Blue Jays can do starting pitching-wise. I'm going to go with the Rangers. I'm looking forward to this series, though. Obviously, some bad blood between the teams, and I think this one's going to go five games.
Jonathan, how about you?
I'm in the same boat. I think the Rangers are going to win. Maybe they win in four, but that's a very unscientific guess in terms of how deep the series go. But I just think the Rangers have been here before. A little more experience. I mean, although there are some experienced guys on the Blue Jays roster, but I see the Rangers moving on.
All right, and then the final series of the division series is the Giants and, of course, the Cubs. Cubs with 103 victories in the regular season. Jonathan, I'll start with you on this one again, and this Giants team that they just keep doing it every other year. They're back in the postseason making a run.
Yeah, they are, and doing it behind Madison Bumgarner, of course, following the script exactly the way they should. And, it's interesting you talk about the Blue Jays and how Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro haven't really been there that long to put a stamp on it. The Giants are all about continuity. Brian Sabian was the general manager forever. He gets bumped upstairs, so to speak. Bobby Evans, who's been part of the front office for almost a quarter century now, is the general manager. So it's not like they had to really change things all that much. John Barr has been running their dress for 9 years now. So top to bottom, they're all on the same page to do what they're doing now. And, a good amount of homegrown players, used to be that they had that all homegrown infield. Third base is up in the air now. But you still have Brandon Belt at first, Joe Panik at second, and Brandon Crawford at short with Buster Posey behind the plate. Bumgarner Posey, for my money, is the, I talked about the best homegrown middle infield. That's the best homegrown battery, I think. And then they've been able to augment it. Even though they still have that strong core, they went all in this year, were really active at the trade deadline. bringing in Matt Moore, bringing in Will Smith. You know, they didn't have that deep of a farm system, but they traded what they had, you know, in order to go for that. And if you think about it, they brought in Matt Moore via trade. They signed Jeff Samardzija and Johnny Cueto as free agents. So 60% of their rotation was brought in from the outside because they identified that they were going to need some help. Guys weren't coming back from injury. You know, maybe they would have liked it if Matt Cain had been able to stay healthy and gotten back to who he was before the injuries beset him, but they weren't able to do that. You know, and then, you know, some key, you know, not as big signs like a guy like Denard Span, which helps solidify them in center field. You know, and I think everyone's going to remember Connor Gillespie's homer in the wild card game for a long time to come. And I was a guy who had a chance to not even be on the postseason roster if it weren't for Eduardo Nunez's injury. He may not have been. So they get contributions from just about everybody when they make these runs. So if their wild card win was any indication, they may be around for a while.
All right, and then the Cubs, Jim, obviously you think of this team as really homegrown with all these young prospects, but that really doesn't tell the real full story.
No, and in fact, they're the least homegrown of any of the teams, and I think that'll change over the next couple of years as more of the guys that they've signed and developed come up through the system, but only five homegrown players on their playoff roster, that's the least. The Giants and the Indians and Rangers all tied for the most with 10. Only three draft picks on the Cubs. That's the lowest in baseball, although one of those is Chris Bryant, who's probably going to be the MVP this year. And again, I think we'll see more going forward. You know, Jorge Soler was a big international signing. Javier Baez, who plays a key role, was a first-round pick by previous regime. And Wilson Contreras was an international signing, too. But it's been mostly done via trades. I mean, when Theo Epstein and Jed Hoyer and Jason McLeod came in, first move they really made was a big one. They traded. It was a four-player deal that was essentially Andrew Cashner to the Padres for Anthony Rizzo, whom all those three guys were in Boston when they drafted when the Red Sox drafted Rizzo, and then Hoyer McLeod traded for him when they were with the Padres. They went on, you know, when they were trying to build the team up, they made a great trade for Kyle Hendricks. They made a great trade for Jake Arrieta. They got Pedro Strop in that deal as well. They made a great trade for Addison Russell. And then when they kind of switched gears, and they were going from rebuilding to contending. They traded for Miguel Montero. They traded for Dexter Fowler. This summer, the big trade was Aroldis Chapman. So they traded prospects for veterans, and they've traded veterans for prospects, and both of those have worked out. They've also made some nice free agent signings. Again, once they were ready to win, went out and signed John Lester at the 2014 winter meetings. And then this past season, they added Jason Hayward and John Lackey and Ben Zobrist, all of whom will play key roles in the playoffs. So I have a feeling that, you know, I think the Cubs are going to be a perennial playoff team for a number of years, and I think when we're doing this story 3-4 years down the line and talking about it in a podcast 3-4 years down the line, probably be a lot more homegrown flavor. But for now, even though the Cubs have a very young team, it's a lot of guys that they traded for when they were on the rise and now have installed into their lineup or into their rotation.
So who wins, Giants-Cubs, Jim?
I'm going to go with the Cubs. I do think, I mean, they have the best team in baseball. To me, they're the favorite to win the World Series, although you got to win three rounds and the best team doesn't always win. I do think, looking at it, the Mets might have been a little bit easier matchup. I think the Mets are kind of banged up. And it'll be interesting. You know, if they split in Chicago in the first two games, they get Madison Bumgarner in San Francisco for game three. It could be a tough series for the Cubs, but I will pick the Cubs.
Jonathan?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Giants have some pitching where they could match up. You know, they get Cueto in game one, and he pitched, you know, well for Kansas City in the World Series last year and had a terrific year. They're, you know, they've got a deep staff, you know, so they go Cueto and Moore one and two. That's pretty good. And then have Bumgarner, as Jim said, waiting game three. That said, I still think that, you know, that's an uphill battle to beat the Cubs. And, yeah, it's rare when the team that everyone expects to win actually does win the whole thing. That's the nature of the postseason, but I still have to think that that the Cubs are going to move on.
Yeah, and that's kind of the, I guess if you had to pick a team that could best put together what the Mets did to the Cubs a year ago with all their pitching, it would be the Giants, but I think the Cubs still have it there. I'll give my picks real quick, guys. I agree with you both on the Red Sox. I'll actually buck the trend and go with the Blue Jays over the Rangers. And then I agree with Jim that the Dodgers will beat the Nationals. And then we all think that the Cubs will get by the Giants despite the Giants' good pitching. So it'll certainly be a lot of fun. And it gets kicked off with the ALDSs today as we record this podcast on Thursday afternoon. And that, guys, brings us to Tim Tebow. We've ignored him a little bit here the last couple of weeks on the podcast while he's continued to keep himself in the spotlight as far as instructional league. You know, he homered in his first at-bat with the Mets down in Florida, but now he's headed to the Arizona Fall League, which is something I don't think we kind of expected to happen. We figure instructs and then maybe that would be it with his football commitments and everything like that. But he is heading to Arizona. Obviously, he won't play every day. He won't be in the lineup every day. He still has those SEC network commitments. So let's start with that. How big a factor is that, Jim, that Tebow will be in the AFL, but he also still will be on television?
I don't think it's a big factor for the AFL, simply because the way the AFL is set up, you have taxi squad players get into action on Wednesdays and Saturdays. He'll miss Saturday. And then nobody plays every day down there because everybody's got prospects who need some playing time. So even if Tim Tebow was in Scottsdale on the Scorpions and staying put, it's not like he's going to play in 30 games. You know, he's probably going to play 15 to 20 games like everybody else. So I don't think that's a factor, Tim. It still bothers me a little bit just from the standpoint that if his heart is set on playing baseball, that this is what he wants to do. He's lost 11 years of at-bats. And, again, I don't think it bothers me. You know, it does not matter with the AFL. Make 100% commitment. It's not like ESPN would say, hey, Tim, you didn't give us notice. You're not welcome here anymore. Tim Tebow would have a job at ESPN if he said, look, I got to walk away from this right now. ESPN would have said, that's fine. Come back whenever you want because you're Tim Tebow. We want you on the SEC network and college football game day and all that coverage. So it bothers me a little bit from that standpoint. But in terms of how it affects him in the AFL, it's not like he was going to play every day. So that it's not really going to affect that.
All right. It's been a while since we've talked about Tebow. Jonathan, since we last talked, I know both of you kind of set it at maybe hovering around 0% his chances of eventually making it to the big league someday. Seeing what he's done in instructs, which is obviously a low level of baseball, and then now that the fact that he's going to the AFL, has your opinion changed at all?
No. I mean, Maybe I'll up it to 2% just because he's going to the fall league. But I mean, they need to challenge him and see what he can handle. You know, because if this is going to work at all, and for it to work at all in terms of, you know, from a player personnel and not a cynical marketing selling merchandise standpoint, he's got to make it to the big leagues, and he's got to do it pretty quickly because he's not 21 or 22. So I think they need to see how he handles the fall league, and that can help determine where he might go to start next year. You know, if he somehow finds some success in Arizona, maybe they can send him to AA, you know, rather quickly, even if they, you know, want to keep him in St. Lucie to start the year and then send him to AA, and then go from there. You know, I think that, you know, it's a small sample size in Arizona. So, you know, it's not like you, if he goes 0 for however or 1 for whatever, you know, it's not, okay, he's done. He clearly can't do it. But that may help inform their decisions in terms of what they want to try to do next spring. I think that's the main thing that they're going to try to examine while he's out there.
And I think the key, too, Jonathan, is, you know, the Instructional League and Arizona Fall League are two entirely different animals. And we, to be honest, I mean, they don't publish Instructional League stats. So we don't even know how he's been doing Instructional League outside of, you know, I've seen parts of
one homer
where there have been stories where he went 4-for-14 with a homer in those three games. But in Instructional League, you have guys, a lot of times teams will have pitchers not throw breaking balls to make them work on their changeups. You might be working on delivery adjustments. You might be, you know, there's not an emphasis on results in Instructional League. It's about learning. And it's a totally different environment facing pitchers doing that than going to the Fall League where, you have a lot of guys who are trying to win spots on 40-man rosters. There's a lot of guys who throw hard. Not that guys weren't trying in instruction league against Tim Tebow. And again, I'll emphasize, we have no idea what his stats were down there, or at least I haven't seen them. But in the fall league, you're going to have guys trying to get him out. Like, it's not going to be, hey, you know, young pitcher, we want you throwing your changeup, lay off your breaking ball. Guys are going to be coming at him with some pretty good stuff. And I think it'll be very telling. I think how he does in the fall league, even though it is a small sample size and stats don't matter in the fall league, but I think just when we see Tim Tebow, if he plays 15 or 20 games and we see how he handles better but not major league caliber stuff on a regular basis, will tell a lot about what's going to happen with him. And I'm looking forward to that.
And I think it's going to be fascinating because, obviously, Arizona Fall League games, there is a grouping of those games that are televised on MLB Network. And so people might get a chance to see Tim Tebow at the plate in an actual game, and that'll be interesting, to say the least. All right, any final thoughts on Tebow from either of you guys?
I would say I'm just interested to see how he does. I'm willing to admit if I'm wrong, but like Jonathan said, I don't think my percentage chance I think he plays in the majors has changed. I would say it's greater than zero because I do think there is kind of a sideshow attraction factor you have to factor in, and that I could see Tim Tebow being a September call-up at some point because he's Tim Tebow. But I just think it's too much of an obstacle to overcome not playing baseball for more than a decade and to, you know, lose – you know, probably 5,000 at-bats over that period of time and be able to come back and make it work.
All right, great stuff, guys. Maybe we check in again on the Tebow topic after the Arizona Fall League is wrapped up when we see what he does down there. And maybe then, maybe your percentages will change one way or the other. Maybe Jonathan's goes back from two back to zero. Who knows? It'll be fun to find out. But great stuff. Wrapping up how these teams were built and, of course, Tim Tebow down in the AFL. That's going to do it for another edition of the Pipeline Podcast. For Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time.